This is the takeaway for January 10th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. Donald Trump isn't president yet, but the Senate is already getting to work on his cabinet picks. Retired General John Kelly goes in front of a Senate committee today in his bid to become Homeland Security Secretary. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama goes in front of the Judiciary Committee as Donald Trump's pick to be Attorney General. Now, Sessions is likely to be confirmed. He's a 20-year senator getting the approval of other senators, after all. But many people don't want it to be easy. In 1986, Sessions was before this very same Judiciary Committee that he's facing today. Back then, it was for a federal judgeship.
I am not a racist. I am not insensitive to blacks. I have supported civil rights activity in my state. I have done my job with integrity, equality, and fairness for all.
Sessions was rejected then because of concerns over his attitudes about race. Senator Sessions was an early supporter of Donald Trump, and during the confirmation hearing today, he was asked if he would follow up on the president-elect's campaign promises to investigate and even charge his opponent, Hillary Clinton, if he's attorney general.
I believe the proper thing for me to do would be to recuse myself from any questions involving those kind of investigations that involve Secretary Clinton.
Jeff Sessions was also asked about holding prisoners at Guantanamo Bay.
It's a safe place to keep prisoners. We've invested a lot of money in that, and I believe it should be utilized in that fashion, and have opposed the closing of it. But as Attorney General,
I just wanted to see if they were still listening.
Some voices from hecklers in the back in the Russell Senate office building there, a familiar sound from many Senate hearings these days. Now, it's not unusual for a close advisor like Jeff Sessions to get rewarded with a cabinet post. What is unusual, though, is that another senator is testifying against Jeff Sessions in front of other senators. New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker will go to the committee urging them to reject Jeff Sessions for attorney general tomorrow. In a moment, we're going to hear from one of Jeff Sessions' defenders, and later this hour, a story of prison and justice in Alabama that crossed paths with Jeff Sessions when he was a younger man and forming the record that he has today. But first, one of the voices that's been the most worried about Jeff Sessions becoming attorney general because of his record on civil rights and voting rights. Janae Nelson is here. She's associate director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we mentioned Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. It's remarkable, maybe even unprecedented, that he's going in front of the Judiciary Committee to testify against a colleague, against Jeff Sessions today. What do you make of it?
Well, what I make of it is that this is really an unprecedented nomination. Jeff Sessions could not be more anathema to the notion of the lawyer for the American people. And I'm not surprised that some of his colleagues on the Senate, even though they may find him to be affable and collegial as a senator, are outraged at the notion that he could possibly be the Attorney General of the United States.
Is your objection mostly on Jeff Sessions' conservative voting record? He has a long record as Attorney General in Alabama, maybe from 25 or 30 years ago before he got to the Senate. He's got a conservative voting record on immigration and on civil rights and even on some voting rights issues in the Senate. Is that where your opposition lies?
My opposition lies with his record over the course of his career, his 44-year career as a lawyer, and two stints where he served as a prosecutor, and he would be occupying a role in the same form as attorney general, and many of the choices that he made in each of those positions that are cause for great concern. He has a proven record of unrelenting hostility to civil rights and principles of equality. So we're not talking simply about a different ideology than what some people may desire. We're talking about someone who has demonstrated true disdain for the principles of equality, and it calls into question his ability to enforce the nation's civil rights laws and key constitutional protections.
So the Attorney General through the Justice Department, of course, Janae Nelson, has responsibilities in enforcing the Voting Rights Act, going to states or counties where there may be irregularities and evaluating those, policing those, and also the Civil Rights Division and the direction in the Civil Rights Division. And you have real concerns over that as well.
Absolutely. The Civil Rights Division has been integral to advancing the civil rights in this country. It was brought about as a result of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, and since then has played such a significant role in ensuring that the victories of that very volatile time in our country in the 1960s and 70s, that those victories actually have some meaning for individuals on the ground. And we know that that requires constant vigilance. And that has been in large part at the behest of the Department of Justice and its Civil Rights Division. Right now, the Department of Justice has several voting rights suits that is engaged in, where it's defending the principles of equal access to the ballot. We have great concern about the Department of Justice's willingness to continue to vigorously prosecute those cases, and importantly, to bring new cases when we have a mounting number of barriers being erected in states across the country to limit voting rights. He has tried himself to try to require proof of citizenship for voter registration. These are all efforts that are being contested in court now and that have been struck down by many federal courts, and yet these are still barriers that he supports and has tried to pass through legislation.
What does civil rights activism look like to you over the next 4 years? What areas are you looking at closely if and when he ascends to this post?
The most important thing, I think, for us to consider is the lack of independence that Jeff Sessions is likely to have with the president-elect when he ultimately becomes president. It has been critical that the Department of Justice has something of a firewall between itself and the president's office. And nothing that Jeff Sessions has done to date suggests that he will exercise the sort of independence in his decision-making from the president that would ensure that the Department of Justice is not being used as some sort of bullying tool by the president and is being manipulated against the people of this country.
Janae Nelson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And now let's turn to a voice defending the record of Senator Jeff Sessions and his nomination to be Attorney General. J.D. Gordon is a former Pentagon spokesman. He's also served as an advisor to Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and Herman Cain when they were running for president, as well as Donald Trump. He worked for 6 months alongside Jeff Sessions on the Trump campaign. J.D. Gordon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on the program.
J.D., you've said that allegations of racism against Jeff Sessions are as credible as Bigfoot sightings and aliens. And that's despite people who testified back in 1986 that he used racial slurs and jokes favorable to the KKK and things like that. Why do you think that this is a smear campaign against Jeff Sessions?
Well, you have to look at his record. I mean, he treats everybody with courtesy, dignity, and respect. I've personally seen that in hundreds of instances. That everybody he meets, he's very kind to, he treats fairly, treats with respect. And then if you look at his record back in Alabama, both as the Attorney General of the state of Alabama and also the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama, he was very much working on behalf of civil rights. If you take a look at desegregation of schools in Alabama, he was a champion of that. If you look at prosecuting the KKK, Senator Sessions actually broke the back of the KKK in Alabama. There was a case where the son of the leader of the KKK, the son of Benny Hayes, was accused of murder, and basically Senator Sessions brought this case as a death penalty case, and he was able to achieve that. They executed the son of the KKK leader in Alabama because Senator Sessions had brought that case when he was the U.S. attorney, and then he oversaw it when he was the attorney general of the state of Alabama. So here's a guy that's committed his whole life to being fair, to doing the right thing. He has excellent judgment. And you know, I work with him very closely on the Trump campaign. You won't find a nicer guy in the United States.
Well, I don't think there's any question that Jeff Sessions is a nice guy and that he's courteous. I can testify to that. But let's talk about his record a little bit more. You just heard about concerns about Sessions' prosecution of the Marion Three in 1984 when he was Attorney General of Alabama, that many people came away from feeling that that prosecution amounted to harassment of black voters and an entrenchment of disenfranchisement in Alabama.
No, I would disagree with that. You know, there are a lot of things that people say that just aren't true. In the 1980s, his nomination for a judgeship was derailed because of hearsay. There was no proof of anything that he actually had said or did not say. It was a he said versus he said type of thing. And also, we've heard things in the United States that we clearly see aren't true. Like, does anybody remember hands up, don't shoot? That was a complete false narrative. Yet a lot of people believed
it. Okay, let's talk about the Marion Three case in 1984 in Alabama, however, when voting rights activists fell under prosecution by Attorney General Jeff Sessions then.
Senator Sessions always acts based upon the law, and he's fair. And so the facts that he had before that case, he thought were prosecutable. And so I'm not going to go back and question him for things he decided in the 1980s for ideas that I believe he had the facts and the law on his side.
How do you think that Jeff Sessions will approach issues of, let's say, policing, which is a big part of the job at the Justice Department as it oversees a lot of police departments at the state and local level? How do you think he'll approach that?
Well, I think he understands that there's been a lot of turmoil in the United States, a lot of unnecessary angst and hostility towards police. And I think he wants a change of attitude in the United States to make sure that we protect and value our law enforcement authorities. Frankly, that hasn't been done recently. We've seen all these attacks on police officers. Some have been murdered. And so I think he wants a change in attitude in the United States. And I think he's the perfect person to serve as the Attorney General.
J.D. Gordon, former advisor to Mike Huckabee, to Herman Cain, and to Donald Trump, and a co-worker, it could be said, with Jeff Sessions on the Trump campaign trail during this 2016 campaign. J.D. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
While Donald Trump assembles his cabinet in front of the Senate this week, he's bringing in others to serve right alongside him inside the White House. Now Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is expected to join the White House as senior advisor to the president. Now, there is a federal anti-nepotism law that prevents government officials from appointing relatives, but
the anti-nepotism law apparently has an exception if you want to work in the West Wing because the president is able to appoint his own staff. So, of course, this came about and to stop maybe family members serving on the cabinet.
Right.
But the president does have discretion to choose a staff of his liking.
That's Donald Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, when she was campaign manager on MSNBC last month. Now, you might be thinking of John F. Kennedy here, right? Hey, didn't he hire his brother, Bobby, to be attorney general? The answer is yes. And that hire is why we now have the anti-nepotism law of 1967, just after the Kennedy era. Jared Kushner will have to clear those hurdles. Meanwhile, like his wife, Ivanka Trump, Kushner has continued to work on the Trump transition while conducting personal business. Jared Kushner is part of the multi-billion dollar real estate empire known as the Kushner Companies. And as recently as mid-November, he met with members of a major Chinese holding company called Anbang Insurance Group to talk about a redevelopment project in Manhattan. Ambassador Norm Eisen served as President Obama's White House ethics czar from 2009 until 2011. He's a former ambassador to the Czech Republic, and he's currently a fellow at the Brookings Institution and chair of the government watchdog group known as CRU. Ambassador Norm Eisen, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, that anti-nepotism law, as I mentioned, goes back to 1967. Lyndon Johnson signed it. What does it say about family members of the president insofar as it applies to Jared Kushner here, not being attorney general, but right in the White House itself? Can he get over it, around it? What does it say?
Well, the anti-nepotism law was passed in the wake of the relationship between Bobby Kennedy and JFK, and there were a variety of other concerns that motivated it. What it says on the face of the statute is that the president cannot employ a family member in an agency, and it expressly identifies not only the president, but lays out the family members, including sons-in-law. So if you read the statute on its face as a layperson, you think, gosh, they can't do that.
Is the way around it that the West Wing is not an agency? I mean, is it as simple as that?
Well, unfortunately, here in the Beltway, nothing is ever as simple as it seems on first reading. And so there's a heated debate. There's a bipartisan group of us who have historically taken a strict reading of the statute. I know myself, when I was in the White House as the president's special counsel, as his ethics are, my Republican counterpart in the Bush administration, Professor Painter, we took the view that it did apply. And we did not permit family members to work in the West Wing or in the White House office, as it's technically called. Others take a more lenient view. The Justice Department has at different times articulated different views. You can get some flavor of the debate from a 1993 D.C. Circuit case, our highest federal appeals court here in the district, just below the Supreme Court, where judges discuss the applicability of this statute to Bill Clinton giving work to his wife, the then First Lady Hillary Clinton. The litigation went on for years, and the judges couldn't agree on whether the statute applied or not under those circumstances. They ultimately decided the case on other grounds, but you had different judges of the D.C. Circuit arguing vehemently one way and the other. So there's a debate about it. What's important to note here is that Mr. Kushner is agreeing to comply with the federal ethics and conflicts and disclosure laws. That's a good thing. And now we need to see how he's going to do that. And we need to evaluate that with very strict scrutiny.
Ambassador Eisen, you know, your Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has a history of going to court and going after people and groups if they behave unethically, in your view. You've laid out sort of the issues at stake. Could you wind up in court against Jared Kushner under the nepotism statute here?
I think the question with Kushner will be, let's see, we must acknowledge, it is a positive step that he says, hey, I'm going to be fully subject to the ethics laws, the conflicts laws, the disclosure laws. Now we got to see, does he really comply with them? We got to look at the facts. More importantly, the big point here is, if Kushner can follow those rules, why can't his father-in-law? And I'm very focused on the precedent that Kushner is setting. Trump has to do the same thing.
And whether it brings more attention, right, to his father-in-law and now boss Donald Trump. Look, two sides of this. Ambassador Norm Eisen of CREW in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
You're hearing their sounds of protesters taking to the streets in Mexico earlier this month. Protesters are out across the country expressing their outrage over increases in gas prices, just one of several problems that the country is facing, from corruption scandals to a plummeting peso that hit record lows last week. Meanwhile, the president, Enrique Peña Nieto, has seen his popularity plummet. It's now down below 25%. On top of it all is the question of President-elect Donald Trump north of the border and what effect his elections will have on the economy in Mexico. Elizabeth Malkin is Mexico correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
What's been interesting here is just spontaneously how widespread the protests are across the country. On Saturday, for example, there was a protest in Mexico City and a much bigger one in Mexico's second city of Guadalajara. There was another protest again here yesterday. There are protests on the border. It's really been quite widespread. By and large, people are genuinely angry and upset, not only about the gas price rises. It's kind of a symbol of everything people have been upset about for some time now.
And let's talk about all those other economic factors that are part of the mix here. Gas prices are rising, as you mentioned. The peso is tanking. And it sounds like the people in the streets may feel like they're under the kind of economic pressure that makes it hard for them to do the regular activities of daily living.
It's more than just that. What it is the sense that they're being asked to sacrifice, and the president has appealed for unity. Yesterday, he announced an agreement to ease the burden on ordinary families, and yet there was really nothing concrete in it. So people are being asked to sacrifice, but there's a sense that politicians have continued in their corrupt ways. Mexico has seen a number of corruption scandals that have cost hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. People are saying, wait a minute, we're being asked to sacrifice. The prices of our ordinary lives are going up that we have to pay. And yet the government seems to be unwilling to do anything about all the money that's been stolen.
Those of us on the outside looking in, of course, from north of the border, always tend to look at economic and political strife in Mexico through the lens of immigration. We've got a new president coming in. Net immigration now is negative, more people leaving the United States than coming in. But how are people in Mexico digesting their own economic situation when their economic relationship with the United States may be changing?
Well, there's a great deal of anxiety here about the Trump presidency. The question is really, how far will he go in keeping his promises, his campaign promises? Because if he does, that will have a huge impact on Mexico, especially renegotiating or even tearing up the North American free trade agreement, which has brought a lot of investment to Mexico and has created jobs. These aren't jobs that always pay as much as they should, but they are solid jobs. They're often much better jobs than many of the informal jobs that people take here. And last week, we saw an announcement that Ford would cancel a planned new assembly plant here. Now, it's unclear really how much President-elect Trump's threats and bullying on Twitter was the reason for that. It also has to do with the market for small cars. Mexico's really become a center for producing small cars. And if, you know, we see more of that, that's a great, great concern to Mexicans.
Elizabeth Malkin, Mexico correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's go to San Francisco now, where officials estimate there are at least 6,700 homeless people living on the streets on any given night. The city's tried lots of policies, but through it all, San Francisco's homeless population has stayed basically the same for the last decade. In the last few years, it's become a lot more visible, as well as gentrification and development have pushed people who used to live in alleys and out of sight into tent cities right across the city. Kevin Fagan is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle who's been covering homelessness for years in the city. He says in San Francisco, the issue boils down to the wealth divide.
San Francisco has one of the greatest splits between rich and poor in the country, and it's one of the least affordable cities in the country. And about 70% of the homeless people we have on our streets started out in San Francisco. So you have people bouncing into poverty from non-poverty, and then you have people coming in from outside. There's a churn. San Francisco made a lot of headway in the mid-2000s by ramping up its supportive housing programs significantly, and then it got stuck. And it's been able to house about 22,000 people over the last decade, but we still have a core of about 6,700 on the streets and couch surfing and in shelters at all times.
Is there a belief then that simply an expansion of the supportive housing that has worked to some extent, at least until the 2000s, as you mentioned, might be part of the solution here? I mean, can San Francisco build its way out of this problem?
There's a belief that that's the way. Sure, sure. There was an initiative launched just this last week or so to house all homeless families within the next 3 years. And that's by using an infusion of new money. The trick is to ramp up quick and then stay ahead of the curve.
I assume in San Francisco, like so many other places, even if these efforts work, you get the argument that staying ahead of the curve and providing housing for homeless people simply changes the incentive structure, provides a perverse incentive, and attracts more homeless people.
Well, you got to use a little stick with the carrot is the general thought. But the bottom line is you save money by housing chronically homeless people. Your typical chronically homeless person in San Francisco costs about $80,000 a year in emergency services to leave them on the street. This is in police calls, cleanup calls, you know, jail stints, and all that. And that's just an average. Now, you put someone into supportive housing, your average cost is about $20,000. It's very simple math.
And now, like in so many American cities, gentrification is a huge force in San Francisco. That does mean this clash between renovation, higher property values, new building, and homeless people who need a place to stay but might have been living in that neighborhood for a long time. How has this clash happened in the city? What does it look like?
Well, it looks like there are more homeless people when there really aren't, because what you have is areas that used to be good hidey holes for people, nice enclaves where you could get away and camp, and they're being developed. And so it's displacing homeless people. So they move to other parts of the city, and suddenly the people in the other parts of the city say, oh my gosh, look at all these homeless people. Another thing that's happened is some really kind-hearted citizens, which some people say are misguided, have been giving tents out to homeless people. So you have more tents than usual.
Is the city more or less tolerant than it was? Is the desire to deal with this problem in a prospective way changing at all?
I don't think so. I've been looking at this for 20 years and more in areas all over the country. It's not new. In fact, San Francisco has some of the more innovative programs in the country. You know, it's one of those things where a lot of times you feel like you're shoveling the tide, but you make headway. Like I said, they house 22,000 people. I'm not trying to sound like Pollyanna here, but there's a lot of progress that gets made. It's getting ahead of it. That's the trouble. And when you have so much poverty in the country that doesn't really get noticed because that's what we've become used to, there's a continuous fountain of poor and desperate people who wind up in our streets.
Kevin Fagan of the San Francisco Chronicle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Just 90 miles northeast of San Francisco, the city of Sacramento and its mayor are also trying to go big in addressing homelessness and mental illness. The new mayor is Daryl Steinberg, and the plan is to free up at least 1,500 housing units for currently homeless people by the springtime. Ultimately, Steinberg says the goal is to achieve what he calls functional zero, the point at which there are more housing units than homeless people who need them. The mayor says he wants tent cities out and instead wants a more permanent solution.
The real solution is increasing our inventory of permanent housing, increasing our capacity to do assertive clinical outreach on the streets, increasing our capacity for case management and supportive services. We know what works here. We just need to commit ourselves to increasing the inventory of what works.
So you call it fair share housing. Is that what that is? Just increasing the number of roofs and the inventory of affordable or low-income housing?
Yes. I mean, in our best programs here in Sacramento, when people want help, when we've got the services to be able to provide them, there is a multi-month wait to get any kind of permanent housing. And that's essentially the problem. It's not housing only, because housing only doesn't work either. But when you combine housing with assertive outreach and case management and supportive services, we can get most people off the streets. And I've seen it work. You know, I authored California's Proposition 63, the Mental Health Services Act, and it's a 1% tax on million-dollar earners, been in place since 2004. And in Sacramento County, for example, we've got 750 people who are housed, getting the services they need currently as a result of Prop 63, similar numbers throughout the state. It's just that the problem in many respects is outstripping the resources. Well, we have more work to do.
How much more inventory do you need to effectively deal with the problem that you have in the county now?
Well, in our city and county, the numbers vary, and it's very difficult to get what they call a point-in-time number. But we're going to seek in the near term close to 2,000 units of permanent housing. We think that will make a big dent. And let me be clear, Todd, about something. You know, no good politician would ever say that they can cure this problem, and I certainly don't think we can cure it. I just think we can make it much better. And that's what we aim to do here in Sacramento.
And so you're talking about a bond issue in Sacramento to help fund this. Are citizens behind borrowing the money to increase the housing stock that you're talking about?
Well, if I might clarify, what we did here, remember, I'm the former head of the state Senate in California, and so I left office because of term limits in 2014. I worked with my successor, Kevin De Leon from Los Angeles, the current president of the Senate, and he passed a $2 billion state bond using Proposition 63, the Mental Health Act, basically bonding against a small percentage of the ongoing revenue. So we now have $2 billion of state funding to be able to put to this problem, not just for Sacramento, but for the other cities and counties throughout the state. The state will take a little time. It's going to take a year and a half, 2 years before that money begins to flow, we think. And so what we're going to do in Sacramento is we're going to look at some of our public housing stock that already exists for low-income people where there are vacancies. We're going to try to direct some more of that housing to the homeless problem. And we think we can get at least the beginning of creating the inventory through that method.
Mayor, a lot of cities, including my hometown of Washington, D.C., require developers when they build high-flying, high-priced new condos to devote a share of the building or a share of the property value to low-income housing. They get the developers involved and they force them to be involved. Sacramento have anything like that?
Well, we do, but it's not strong enough. We have what's called a housing trust fund that's basically paid out of fees from developers. And frankly, there's just not enough money in it. And so, you know, I've been mayor now for a little over 3 weeks. And one of my top priorities is to find ways to not only replenish, but to enhance that housing trust fund so that we have more ability to build or to rehabilitate workforce and affordable housing.
So you're dealing with this problem locally, obviously, Mayor, and on the state level where you just came from. If you look east to Washington, the debate over Obamacare and even a longer-term debate over Medicaid, communities like yours could be facing some substantial cuts to Medicaid in the next couple of years, and that seems like it might put pressure on what you're trying to do in quite the opposite way.
There's no question about it. I mean, what we've worked very closely with the Obama administration to gain what they call waivers under the Medicaid, what we call Medi-Cal here in California. And some of those waivers now enable us, for example, to provide what we call whole person care, whatever it takes for people who are on the street and dealing with severe mental illness. And so those dollars and the flexibility that we now have is really important. And of course, we're all, to put it mildly, nervous about the new administration, the Trump administration, on a whole host of levels. And, you know, as I've said many times out here since November the 8th, we will work with the administration where we can, and we will fight it and him where we must. And certainly, there are a lot of areas for concern, and that's one of them.
So, Mayor Steinberg, you've been mayor just for 3 weeks, as you've said. So what's the metric of success here? What's the promise where voters in Sacramento will know if you've followed through on this new housing and your new program for the homeless?
The measure ought to be whether or not it's simply better, and whether people feel it's better, and whether we can show that the numbers on the street are less than when I started. I have no illusions about how difficult this is going to be. But, you know, what's the point of holding, you know, responsible high public office if you're not going to try to make better a social condition that, frankly, to all of us, we've grown numb to? The fact that in 2017, in our state, in our country, that this condition persists, we know we can do much better. And I'm going to try. That's what I promise. I'm really going to try.
Functional Zero is the goal against homelessness for Daryl Steinberg. He's the new mayor of Sacramento, California. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Look forward to being on again.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you today. If the election was an emotional day for you, Election Day, consider what it was like for Jade Chance.
My father passed on Election Day. He didn't pass a day before or a day after. He passed the morning of Election Day. And so I feel like that was only symbolic that where we're moving as a government and a country is not at all something that's going to instill life into our prison systems. It's going to do just the opposite.
Jade's father, Philip Chance, spent the majority of his life in prison in Alabama. It's home state, of course, to Senator Jeff Sessions, who's likely to be the next attorney general. Today, in partnership with Case in Point, we look at the history of Philip Chance and his life in and after prison. In 1971, Philip Chance was just 15 years old and living in Michigan. While visiting family in Choctaw, Alabama, he went with his older brother and a cousin to the local convenience store. Chance later said that he didn't know that inside his cousin robbed and killed a white convenience store clerk. Now, all three of them were charged with murder. Philip cooperated with the police, and on the advice of his appointed attorney, he pled guilty and was sentenced to life in prison with the chance of parole. The idea there was that if he behaved, he'd have a shot at release. I talked with Philip Chance's oldest daughter, Jade Chance, who we heard from a moment ago, and also with Andrew Cohen, commentary editor for the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Philip Chance was known as a model inmate while in prison. He was up for parole 10 years after being sentenced, and that's when things took an unexpected turn.
10 years after he gets the life sentence with the possibility of parole, he's up for parole. And that parole is denied. And so he feels hopeless. He feels like he's never going to get the justice that he deserves or had been promised by his lawyers. And so he takes off. He goes back to Michigan and back home. There, he starts a life. Alabama doesn't go after him right away. He becomes a father. He gets married. He starts working using his skills that he had learned in prison as a sort of a prison paralegal, helping folks out in Michigan and Detroit, and generates a constituency of support, a political and legal constituency where people actually care about his story.
And Andrew, let me stop you right there real quickly, because what you're describing is a situation where Philip Chance was not in hiding. He wasn't on the lam in Michigan. He had very much had a public life.
He had a public life. One of the ironies of the story is the more public his life became in Michigan, the angrier the folks in Alabama got. So to make the longer story short, he is granted asylum by one governor after another in Michigan as sort of a man who shouldn't be forced to go back to Alabama because of that state's notorious injustices, especially racial injustices, in its prison system. So Michigan is protecting Philip Chance. He's leading a productive life. And for 14 years, his drama plays out in federal courts, one after the other, with Alabama fighting to get extradition of him and Michigan resolutely saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep him here. He's living a productive life. He's not hurting anyone. And it would be an injustice to return him. Finally, Alabama wins. And he gets sent back down to Alabama in 1996. And here again, there's a twist in the story. He's up for parole 3 years later, and he gets parole in Alabama. And at that point, Alabama officials could have said, all right, he's come back for justice. He's served additional time. We're going to allow him to be released. Only they don't. The entire sort of political infrastructure in Alabama fights the parole board decision, and he gets stuck in prison where he remained for the rest of his life until he died in November, a very sick man who, even until the end, wasn't getting the health care that he had asked for in prison.
Is it fair to say, Andrew, that in the end, during all those intervening years of parole and then parole taken away, that there was a sense of get back, maybe, from Alabama? This guy made a fool of us in front of Michigan and in front of everyone else, and he's just never getting out?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there was a sense from Jeff Sessions and William Pryor, who's now an 11th Circuit federal judge, from the governor, that this is somebody who had made the state look bad. This was somebody who could be made an example of, a black man who had run away, a fugitive. And so Alabama wanted to throw the book. But even then, remember, the parole board was so impressed by his behavior in prison, so convinced that he wasn't going to be a danger, that the parole board essentially endorsed the release. And even at that point, essentially the executives came in and changed the makeup of the parole board to make sure that there was no parole ever granted again.
So Philip Chance, Jade, leaves Alabama, gets back to Michigan. This was when you and your sister came into the picture, because you were born during that time when he was back in Detroit with your mom.
Yes. My dad probably met my mom about 4 or 5 years after being back. I was born in 1986. By the time I was 10, my father was gone. And that was pretty much the last time I have ever seen him as a free man. I have one major childhood memory that stands out in my mind of just spending quality time with my father as a daughter. I was probably about maybe 8 or 9. And, you know, it was a regular day. It wasn't anything necessarily special. For whatever reason, I can't really remember exactly why, but I wasn't having a great day. But I remember him looking over and asking me, would you like to go get some ice cream? Nothing extravagant or anything, something really simple. He just looked over and said, would you like to go get some ice cream? And I said, of course. You know, of course I'd like to go get some ice cream. And we went to the Dairy Queen, and I'll never forget, he ordered the biggest ice cream sundae with bananas and cherries and syrup and all of the goodies. And we sat there and split a sundae and just talked. And for whatever reason, that memory is like burned in my brain. It's something that I'll never forget, because even in its simplicity, it was one of the few times that all of the hustle and bustle stopped, all of the reporting stopped, all of the fighting and acquiring support and fundraising and rallying, and all of that just kind of took a halt for a moment. And it was just me and my dad.
Is there justice now that your father is gone and passed away? Is there justice in the legal sense left?
Absolutely not. The last conversation that I had with my father was him calling from prison after sitting in a prison cell for a week and a half, almost 2 weeks, with fluid on his lungs, frustrated because he could not get the medical attention he needed to have someone send him out to the hospital, because after being sick for so long, people started treating him with the premise that you're going to die soon anyway, so there's no need for us to spend the money to send you out to the hospital. We'll just let you be. That's not something easy to bear for a daughter. In regards to, legal accountability, there has been none shown. I don't know if anybody has ever heard in any case where you're granted the parole and then 24 hours later, the governor removes someone from the parole board, appoints them with the police chief so that then the decision could be in alignment with what they desire, and then rescind and take back a parole in 24 hours. I've never heard of it.
A story of a young life in prison, journeys of 1,000 miles from south to north and back again, of parole and of a black man in the South in the American criminal justice system. Andrew Cohen, commentary editor at the Marshall Project, author of Case in Point. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Jade Chance, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, President Obama gives his final address in office tonight. We've been asking you what message you have for the outgoing president. From Jamie Fay on Twitter, thank you for believing in us. We'll try not to let you down. You can tweet us your goodbye to the president at The Takeaway using the hashtag Farewell44. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at FloridaTheFutureIsHere.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.